Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
White Hot Magazine, one of the world's leading platforms for contemporary art. Hello, my name is Rena Oh, and I am a guest host for White Hot Magazine Podcasts, one of the leading platforms bringing lively discussions, innovative, fine artists, thought leaders, and active creatives, which is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Here in the art world, I am delighted to interview Peter Rosen, who's one of the most critically acclaimed documentary storytellers of the 20th and 21st centuries. He is currently in the midst of preparing the premiere of the latest work, Larry Rivers, the Bad Boy of the Art World. Today, I am sitting down with Peter, along with a commentator who's a fellow actor and composer, with a rich history of a family of art collectors. Peter Rosen has produced and directed over 100 full-length films and television programs, which have been distributed worldwide and have won awards at all the major film festivals. He has worked directly with some of the most important figures in the arts, such as Leonard Bernstein, Yo-Yo Ma, Beverly Sills, Cheryl Milnes, Stephen Sondheim, Alexander Gudinov, Midori, Martha Graham, Placido Domingo, Van Cleburne, Claudio Arrau, Byron Janis, Ian Pei, and Garrison Keillor. The film, Who Gets to Call It Art? A Story About Henry Galitzer, the curator at the Met responsible for single-handedly changing America's contemporary art spectrum, is one of the most critically acclaimed documentaries. Henry discovered artists such as Jasper Johns, John Chamberlain, Frank Stella, Andy Warhol, amongst many others. It was ranked as the number 4 out of 10 best films by Time magazine during the year of its release. I am honored to have had the opportunity to interview one of the most unique cinematic storytelling pioneers in American cinema. We were fortunate enough to have a great host, Fritz Michel, who's an accomplished composer and actor, and grandfather. Jules Bach was one of the greatest art collectors of masterpieces, and collection included works by Goya, Rembrandt, Botticelli, Filippo Lippi, and many more that are found today at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Peter Rosen's film can be found on Vimeo, and I highly recommend watching Who Gets to Call It Art, First Person Singular, Ian Pei, Caruso, God's Fiddler, amongst many others that are my favorites. With a bachelor's degree in architecture and an MFA from Yale, Rosen's colorful body of work is filled with stories of subjects that are captured uniquely in every documentary. Peter is furthermore a judge for the Director Guild Awards and the Emmys. I am looking forward to the premiere of his latest film, Larry Rivers, the Bad Boy of the Art World. So how are you today, Peter?
Good. It's good to be here with you, Rita, and looking out over this beautiful skyline of northern Manhattan on a perfect May spring day. So we're all in a very good mood.
Cool.
Good. You caught me while I'm in a good mood.
Yeah, cool. That's awesome. What about you, Fritz?
I feel great. I'm glad to have you both here.
Thank you. Thank you for having us and being
a
great host. So, Peter, I would like to know what your childhood was like.
Well, you know, I think I have to go back to when I was a little kid, like 6 or 7 years old. I began to really be interested in photography because I had an aunt, my mother's sister, Maria, who, by the way, was a voluptuous woman who had a tiny waist, large breasts, and was really beautiful with shiny red hair. and she worked at the United Nations as a photographer. She was the chief photographer for the Soviet delegation for the United Nations in the 60s when I was a little kid. And she caught so much attention that, for example, when Khrushchev and people like that would come to the UN, they would say, "Where's Maria? Where's Maria?" She was like a real character.
Well, I mean, with her voluptuous,
I don't blame them. But at any rate, because she was a photographer and I grew up pretty close to her, she was in our house in Riverdale all the time. She taught me photography at a pretty early age. She gave me one of those little plastic Ansco cameras, and I went all over the place taking pictures. And the big advantage for me was because she worked at the UN and had access to the UN darkroom, which was a huge place. The United Nations turned out hundreds, if not thousands, of photos every day of every meeting and every dignitary. So I would take some pictures with my little camera, and then she would bring back beautiful 8x10 glossy prints of everything I took. So I was very, in the right hands there. And I remember one of the first things that I started to do was we lived in a place that looked out over the Hudson River, and you could see the George Washington Bridge down the river. And I just began to take photos of the George Washington Bridge. I did a whole study of that. This is when I was like maybe 7 or 8 years old. And that carried through all the way through high school. As a freshman in high school, they saw me with cameras all the time, and they by then I had graduated to a little better cameras like my Leicas. And I became the photo editor of the Fieldston News, our Fieldston High School newspaper, which actually published a paper every morning, Monday through Friday, which is unusual for a high school, probably even to this day. So that's how things started, as a real serious interest in still photography.
And you mentioned that you afterwards studied architecture at Cornell University.
Yeah, I went to Cornell for architecture, and then I got my master's at Yale in graphic design. And that's sort of, it wasn't really that I was somebody who drew well or was that interested in architecture. I don't know, my father thought it was a good profession. I didn't think too much about it. You know, when you're 17 years old, it's not a great idea to already choose what your profession is going to be. But so, Cornell is an undergraduate architecture program, so you don't do anything else there from the time you're a freshman in college.
So rewinding back to selecting architecture as your major, is that something that you wanted to pursue at the time, or you just sort of picked it, out of...
I was sort of, I didn't even pick it. It just sort of somehow in my family, they thought that was, my father was a lawyer, an accountant, and a lawyer. My mother was just a housewife. It seemed, I guess, to them that was a noble profession or something that you could make a good living at. I think they're happier that I, was going to go into architecture as opposed to acting or some kind of job like Fritz had.
I was going to say it's somewhere between being an artist and an engineer. It feels a little bit safer.
That's right. Yeah, it is a little bit on the art side, but on the other hand, it's a profession where people actually make a living as opposed to
that's
being
right.
an artist where you don't
it's
make
practical.
A living.
It's
or
practical.
An actor where you don't
right.
make a living.
Yeah. You won't be starving.
But the thing is, while I did not become an architect, I think that training was really, really important because architecture isn't designing the facade of a building. It's more like understanding programmatic challenges, structure, and all the things that have to go on in your mind when you're either making a painting, making a film, making a sculpture. All the actual basic intrinsic things about the arts are in architectural training. Aside from the fact that you learn to do really hard work and work almost all night, and then you're on what's called charrette, which means you gotta get your drawings up on the board to be criticized. And then secondly, the architecture training is something that I wish we had a little more of today. You got severely criticized on everything you did. The architects who were the teachers, they didn't worry about like microaggressions like students have today, and students today have to be treated with kid gloves, otherwise they get upset and the teachers get in trouble for saying the wrong thing. In architecture, you just put your drawings up, and the idea is a very severe critique. You could do the greatest work in the class, and you're still going to be really pummeled and talked to in a rude way, and they're going to say, that is fucking awful. I don't want to see that kind of work anymore, you know. And that's how architects are trained. They're beaten down to nothing. And that, for some reason, that's always been in almost every architecture school in America and Europe. That's how they teach architecture. So in a way, that's a very good background to have as you then, you know,
go to the art.
It almost sounds like you're in the military.
You're going to deal with the real world that way, and not like kids come out of school today and they're so coddled that they're not prepared for what goes on in their professions, whatever that might be.
You did mention, though, that when you graduated, you designed one building in Europe.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I have two claim to fames. One, the thing about architecture is it's a really noble profession, and very few people actually get to be the designers or head up a firm where they're doing important design work. So most students end up going into other fields anyway. For example, in my class at Cornell, we had 60 freshmen, 20 of us graduated, and out of that 20, only two or three became architects. And that's not unusual. That's pretty much the odds that exist in all the schools. So, so you usually don't do architecture after school. I was lucky in only two cases. Right after school, I got a job with a large firm that were designing the Caribe Hilton Hotel.
That's a pretty
Caribbean.
Big job.
And my job was I designed all the bathroom details in the Caribe Hilton. So if you ever go down there to San Juan, you know, there's beautiful black tiled bathrooms with recessed lighting. That was my design. And then during school, we had
that's noble.
Yeah.
We'll spend a lot of time there.
Yeah.
In the bathrooms.
And then we had one semester at Cornell where you could work out of the country. And they assigned you to different places. Some kids went to work in the Peace Corps. I had a job with an architect in London who were working on the London Airport at Heathrow. And because I was coming from America, they thought I was going to be some sort of special designer or especially creative. So I had a note on my desk when I got there. It said, let the new American assistant do this project. And it was a house for a priest attached to a church. So I spent the summer working on that. I think this goes way back. We're talking about, you know, the 70s here. I think they sent me some photos of the thing when it was finally built, but that was about my career in architecture. That's as far as I got.
So this is after you received your MFA from Yale?
No, that's before. Before.
Oh, so this is right before
during
you,
school,
you
yeah.
ended up,
yeah.
you
Graphic
decided
design.
To go back and get your master's.
Yeah, and then at Yale, I was graduating from Cornell right in the middle of all the recruitment for the Vietnam War. And almost every student in America had to figure out some way to stay out of Vietnam because the chances were very good you could be killed there. This was not like a minor skirmish somewhere like when we sent troops to Afghanistan or something.
I cannot imagine you in Vietnam.
No, I don't think many college students went. Unfortunately, Vietnam was such a disaster that
a lot of people went there.
You weren't there.
No, but a lot of people ended up there who didn't imagine that they would.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Because it was a draft, and you couldn't get out. You only could get out of it if you could show them you were mentally insane for some reason. And kids would go to the draft board and stand on their head and talk gibberish and do all kinds of stuff to try to get out, but that usually didn't work. The other reason was you could get what was called a 2S deferment, which means teaching. So graduate school obviously kept me out, and then after I got my master's, I stayed up in New Haven to teach because Yale offered almost everybody a 2S deferment, so you could stay out of Vietnam. So that's really what...
I think my parents got married.
Hmm?
I think my parents got married.
Yeah. But you could... if you were married, you wouldn't be drafted?
I think that was right back then.
Yeah. Well, that probably was the easiest way out.
Yeah.
But it was a really going to graduate school at Yale for graphic design was because of the Vietnam War. And normally, I would just want to go out and get a job and start to, you know, have a real life, not stay in school so long. Because Cornell was a 5-year program, Yale graphic design was a 3-year program. That's like 3 years in college. That's like 8 years in college. It's almost like getting a PhD.
Graphic design.
Years. And it's too much time to stay in school. You're wasting a big part of your younger life in a fantasy world on a college campus as opposed to going out and getting a real job.
So what was it like after you graduated? Did you take some time off? Did you go dive right into working? And
no, I think, you know, there's really no time off when you start making films. I mean, it sort of becomes what you do. And I kind of one day put down the still cameras and picked up an Arri S, which is a small 35 millimeter film camera.
And this is while you were in school?
Yeah, while I was in school, we had a pretty good program at Yale where they got some money from Joseph E. Levine, who was a big-time movie mogul in the 60s and 70s. He made The Graduate, Carnal Knowledge, Gandhi, A Bridge Too Far. He was like the Harvey Weinstein of the 60s and 70s.
Before Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, he made Two Women with Sophia Loren and got an Academy Award for that. Yeah. So Joe Levine, who became a friend of mine, gave a grant to Yale for filmmaking of $100,000. And in those years, there were very few young people who wanted to have anything to do with media or film. It's interesting. It's such a popular field now. You look at the classes at NYU and USC and UCLA. Everybody wants to go into media, you know, film and television. In those years, there were only about two or three of us on the whole Yale campus who had any interest at all in film. So I, with one other guy, and one guy who was interested in sound recording, we had access to that $100,000. No one else seemed to want that grant. So I began to make some, using that money, I began to make some short films up at Yale.
I have a question for you. Going back to the $100,000 in the 1960s, what would that be equivalent to today?
About $1 million.
That's a pretty decent amount of money to play with as a
I didn't have the whole thing, but the money was there at Yale to do whatever you wanted. In other words, we bought an Arri BL, which is a big blimped 16 millimeter camera. We bought a Nagra for the school, which is a professional sound recording.
There are no film schools, I guess.
No, there's no film school. Yale had a film studies program, but that was more looking at films of Kurosawa and Charlie Chaplin and writing papers on the films you saw, not actually making films. The other big advantage for me, and I guess I was lucky because the art school where I was doing the graphic design MFA was right next to Yale Drama School. And at the time, Yale Drama School was a really famous place. Barbara Garson, Ken Brown, all kinds of people who were writing important off-Broadway plays and musicals were at Yale Drama School under Bob Brustein, who was the dean there, who was very famous in the theater, as Fritz would know.
Of course.
And so I was able to make some films for the Yale Drama School, like a lot of the students, like Meryl Streep, for example, was there. They all wanted to go out and make films, so I was the only guy who knew how to shoot. So I was shooting a lot of like drama, short films for some of the Yale Drama School students, which was really good training.
Were you also editing these films?
Yeah, then we set up a Moviola, which is, this is before the days of electronic digital editing.
Right.
You had a big Moviola with wheels going around and a little screen. It made a lot of noise. So we also bought, with that Joe Levine money, we bought a Moviola to do the editing.
So going back to the Moviola editing, and you're using Filmstrip, did you have to cut the film?
That's up until recently, the whole history of cinema was people had glue, splicers, and scissors, and you cut pieces of film and stuck them together, and if you didn't like it, you undid the splices and tried something else, but it was all hands-on.
Sounds
it was
very
like a craft.
Much like creating a collage. Of film
and
strips.
Much more artistic than now when you have editors and filmmakers sitting in electronic laptops putting stuff together. It's really not the same experience, and I don't think it results in the same type of work that you had up until recently. You know, if cinema is 100 years old, 90 years of that we're cutting and splicing pieces of film. So it's only recently that it's changed. And I don't think it's for the better. You know, a lot of films are pretty kooky and they don't really tell a story in a clear way. Because
they don't hold together as well.
So many crazy things
are
done. You can do so many crazy things in the editing. It's great for promos. It's great for trailers. It's great for advertising, for 30-second ads, some of the editing. But when you have that kind of editing on a feature film, after 5 or 10 minutes, you know, you can't. You lose the story thread. You don't really
I'm with you on that.
Yeah, and so the traditional editing of strips of film in bins all around a big room, like maybe thousands of strips of film, and you had to know which one was. You had to go up to it and look at it against the light to see what shot that was.
Wow. Is there any way that you can take those strips of films and make prints out of them? Because it is it's a positive.
You could, you know, it's probably been done. Yeah, you could take any frame and blow it up, and you could have it on the wall and have it like a storyboard for what you're working on, which would be a good
We could probably talk about that after the podcast.
But I'm just getting to the point that, you know, back at Yale, there weren't too many people making films, and you asked about how did I first start working? It's more like that you put down your still camera, you start shooting film for people, and then you make your own films, and one leads to another. At Yale, I made a short film called I'm a Man about a black guy named John Barber, who came from Africa and would wear African robes and accoutrements, and he also always carried a spear around with him. I don't know if you saw that one. It's online.
No, I haven't seen
it. I have to send you the link for that. And because he carried a spear around campus, one day when I was filming him, the police came up and arrested him for carrying a dangerous weapon. And he went to court. We followed through in this short film the whole trial of whether the spear was a dangerous weapon or part of his African garb. Yeah.
And this is during the 60s. So
yeah, this is when the Civil Rights Movement was just in its infancy. So it became a really important short that McGraw-Hill bought and was distributed to high schools and classrooms all over the country. It was really successful. Made some money as my first film. I showed that to Joe Levine when the money was at Yale, and he backed the next film, which was called Bright College Years, which was about the whole Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Black Panther riot at Yale in 1970.
I need to see that film.
You saw that, didn't you?
No, I didn't.
Oh, that's on my site.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. So Bright College Years was the first major film I made, and because it was backed by Joe Levine, his company, Avco Embassy Pictures, distributed that in theaters all across the country. And here I am, you know, like 21 years old with a feature film out there under the banner of a major... It would be like today that your first film would be picked up by 20th Century Fox and put into major theaters.
It sounds like you were doing pretty good.
I think that was sort of the times, and it was lucky. And I'm just pointing it all out because one project leads to another. You know, I made that short, and then Joe Levine backed the feature length documentary, and then I stayed in New Haven, got married there, had my first child there, and taught at Yale for a while, and then set up an office in New York.
And then afterwards, you mentioned you started making government films.
Yeah, you know, that was the way in the 70s and 80s that you could get started, which I don't think exists today. The government was called Hollywood on the Potomac. They made more films than Hollywood in Washington, D.C., because we had agencies like United States Information Agency that made propaganda films to show around the world about different aspects of American culture.
I'm thinking about those World War II films that all the great filmmakers made.
Well, that was going on in Washington in the 70s and 80s, and they would publish the projects in the Commerce Business Daily. And you could get that newspaper every morning and look at the listings, like want ads. We want a filmmaker to make a film about this volcano in Arizona.
Oh, these were job listings that you found in the
Well, not job listings.
Newspaper?
They listed the project.
Okay.
And they would say, we want a production company to bid on this project.
And back in those days, there weren't too many production companies.
No, it was competitive, but I was one of the companies that kept bidding on these things. And if you bid on enough of them with a lower budget, and I was just getting started, so I didn't have a lot of overhead. I didn't have to make, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on every project. So I could send in a low bid. And I got a lot of really interesting projects. I think throughout the 80s, I was working for almost every government agency, the Park Service, the Navy, USIA. We made about 8 films for USIA. And that was not only a really good experience, but it was a way just to learn how to make documentaries. And they sent you all over the world. I made a film called The Global Weather Experiment, which we shot on all 7 continents about weather balloons and how they collected weather data all over the world. So I was... even though I was bringing up a young family with 2 young kids, I was traveling all the time, you know.
But you were also a breadwinner who had a steady
job. You could eke out a profit on all these government films. I think we must have filmed almost in every state of America and in quite a few other countries. We did a film about the monsoon in India. I had to go there. The monsoon didn't come. So all the crew went back to New York, and then as soon as we got back, the monsoon came, so we had to fly back to India. But I was on the flight a lot. I was in Washington so often that there was an Eastern Airlines shuttle that left every half hour from LaGuardia to Washington, D.C. It was like a bus, so you didn't even need to book a ticket ahead of time.
I just walked on the plane on the shuttle.
And I was on that flight so much, every stewardess on that knew me. Hi, Peter, you're back today, you know. It was sort of my early first 10 or 15 years of my career was doing that.
Those are like during the times when the stewardess actually looked like those Pan Am styled.
Oh, yeah. Right.
You know, right?
And you could smoke on the plane. And if you were talking to somebody, like say you had a meeting at the airport and you had to take off, the person you're talking to could come right on the plane and continue talking to you, and then the stewardess would come and say, oh, we got to take off now, you got to leave, and whoever you're having a meeting with would leave the plane.
Oh, right, they didn't have TSA and all
those
things.
No, TSA. Just walk on and off the plane, nobody cared.
Were they serving martinis? Yes.
It's so ridiculous today, because we had one shoe bomber once, how many years ago?
Yeah. Like
30 years.
Everyone going on a flight now, millions and millions of people per week, have to take their shoes off. I mean, it's the most absurd.
Oh, is that where that comes from?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because
one
of one
incident.
Guy. Yeah.
One incident.
I mean, it just shows how stupid and ridiculous all these flight regulations are.
I always forget
in terms of security.
To wear socks.
It's
just horrible.
I know, your feet can get really dirty at the airport.
You have to spray sanitizer on your feet. You also mentioned Leonard Bernstein several times during our meetings, and how significant he was in the culture.
Well, you know, that actually relates to what we just were talking about in terms of government films. The film on Bernstein was one of the USIA projects. Yeah, USIA had a series called Reflections, and my assignment was we went to some very famous people, like Samuel Eliot Morison, the historian, Buckminster Fuller, the architect, and the idea for Reflections was let your subject talk right to the camera in a close-up, and with very few outside prompts, let that person tell his or her whole life story. So with Bernstein, I knew very little about him. I knew very little about music. I wasn't a musician. I had 12 years of piano lessons when I was a kid, and I still couldn't play anything. So I'm not cut out for performing music. I played the clarinet in the high school orchestra, not very well. Although Benny Goodman once did play my clarinet, because we had when I grew up in Riverdale, we lived next door to Richard Simon, who was the founder of Simon & Schuster, father of Carly Simon, Joanna Simon, and Lucy Simon, who were great singers. So they always had celebrities at their home. We played ball with Jackie Robinson on their front lawn as kids. And one day Benny Goodman was at their house, and I was learning the clarinet, and somebody asked Benny Goodman to play the clarinet. He said, I don't have my instrument here, I can't. And I raised my hand and said, Mr. Goodman, I have one right next door, you know. So I brought it over, and Benny Goodman played my clarinet. That was made that clarinet famous in my high school. But other than piano lessons and playing the clarinet, I wasn't a musician. And when I met Bernstein, it was kind of a steep learning curve about learning what a conductor, what a composer is all about. And that was one of the first USIA films. So all that work for the government sort of led to interesting new things, because after working with Bernstein, a lot of musicians would come to me, like Isaac Stern, Yo-Yo Ma, Midori.
That's how I sort of got typecast.
Okay. Yeah,
you acquired
your
niche in a sense.
Yeah, and I.
It's not typecast.
And then we made films on
your
great.
Finding your métier in a way.
Great artists of the past, like Arthur Rubinstein, the pianist, Toscanini, Caruso.
I love the Caruso film, by the way. I always pronounce his name, the prodigy. Heifetz?
Yasha Heifetz?
Heifetz, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm pronouncing it correctly today.
Yeah.
I watched that film probably 100 times. It was just playing nonstop all day long for 2 weeks.
Well, I'm glad to know I have a fan out there.
Oh, I'm one of your biggest fans.
But that Bernstein project, while working with him, was always something, you know, that was kind of fascinating because he was quite a character. I did then go into years and years of just working with musicians or on projects about musicians, either current or, you know, famous names from the past. So I think that, all, as you were saying earlier, you know, one thing sort of leads to another.
This was
a great
all
time
still
to discover all these musicians, too. I mean, golden age.
So this was all part of the government-funded films, the Bernstein?
The Bernstein was, yeah.
Okay. And you did mention that once Nixon became president, all those projects...
Yeah, unfortunately, USIA folded up after Nixon, and it became ICA, International Communication Agency. They had to change all their letterheads and stationery and contracts, and then that only lasted a few years. And then the government stopped making propaganda films for use overseas. For example, the Bernstein film was made because the government felt that in Europe and Asia, there was a thinking that we didn't have culture here. We knew how to make automobiles. We built great skyscrapers. America was a place of great scientific advancement, but that we had no culture. So the government thought that we needed to make films to show that we had a real cultural heritage here. So they picked people as subjects like Leonard Bernstein, who was very patriotic and agreed to do it because he wanted to do something for the country. So these subjects were accessible.
I've heard a lot of these abstract expressionist painters also got their start from these films as well. The same thing, this idea of the government promoting
the other
our culture.
Yeah, the art side of that is WPA, which hired...
Diego Rivera.
Some great American artists. Trying to think of who's
Pollock.
Pollock was paid by all the abstract expressionists were paid by WPA to do their work, to do murals all over America. But so that's really why government was way ahead of its time then to try to make sure America had a good image overseas. Look at what we have today. We have the most negative image you could possibly have, because that's one of the reasons we dropped the whole idea of propaganda. The Chinese do propaganda. What do you think? That's what TikTok is. TikTok is Chinese propaganda. So we don't have that anymore, and I think the country kind of in its overall foreign relationships has really suffered from that.
So do you in some way think that Hollywood took over this entire propaganda and film industry? Because
No, you know, Hollywood came into the picture because they made entertainment. It wasn't the same thing at all. It wasn't propaganda.
And you never really delved into the Hollywood scripted film.
You know,
category.
I think every filmmaker always had, and you always had in your back pocket some sort of project or screenplay or something that you would hope you could go out to Hollywood to do. Just before you started this interview, I was talking to Fritz about, because he spent so much time in Hollywood as an actor. I would go out there almost once a week because of different projects, different meetings, different projects I was pitching. I had optioned some books that I thought would be good movies. One of the books I optioned, no one was interested in, and then I got a call from Sidney Pollack's office. And when we were talking, she didn't know who Sidney Pollack was, but he was probably the most important producer out there, and one of the most famous actors out there. He made Don't Shoot Horses. Don't Shoot Horses.
They Don't Shoot Horses.
Yeah, and many other famous films. But at any rate, Pollack was interested in the same book that I had optioned. For some reason, I don't know how he heard about it. So his office called me up and said, "We understand you have the option to this book. Come out to L.A. and meet with Sidney." That was another example of that. There were dozens of meetings, dozens of trips to L.A., and of course the film never got made, because in Hollywood, it's very hard to get something off the ground. If you're not there every day, if you're not part of every dinner, every breakfast, every meeting, if your office is in New York and you're flying out to L.A. once a week or once a month, you're not part of the scene that puts together the mechanics of these projects. And no matter how good your project is, you might have it packaged with the best possible actors, And you might have a great executive producer like Sidney Pollack. It still doesn't work unless you're there, you know, pushing it. You've got to be part of that community. And I was born in New York, loved New York. I never wanted to pick up my family and move to a kooky place like Los Angeles to live.
I can't picture you in Hollywood either, or Vietnam.
No,
just,
okay.
I picture you, you know, you have an Ivy League education, yeah. And I love what you've done with your body of work. Just in case Fritz doesn't know, Peter has made over 100 films.
I saw.
You saw?
I did see.
And one of my favorite is Who Gets to Call It Art? Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I've always was interested, this goes back to Yale graphics in a way, I was always interested being in school in New Haven in the art department in what was going on in downtown New York at the time. This was like the late 60s and with pop art on the move and a very vibrant downtown art scene. I was only an hour and a half away. I actually had a motorcycle at the time. I had a BMW 650, so I enjoyed riding this motorcycle into Manhattan and back whenever I could. And I began to hang out downtown. I met people like Jim Dine and other people who were important artists at the time. So always, from the time I was in college, I always thought there was something exciting happening in the art world in downtown New York from the 60s on. But over the years, I could never really figure out how to make a film about that. And then many years later, somebody came to my office and told me about Henry Geltzahler. This was, I think, an aunt of his who was a psychiatrist, Barbara. And she said, our family is thinking of, because Henry was a curator at the Met, people don't even know what a curator is or what a curator does. He was sort of a remote behind-the-scenes character. And she said, our family is thinking about having a book written about Henry Geltzahler. Do you know anybody who can do that kind of thing? And I thought about it, and I said, you know, it's such a visual story. Here's a curator who discovered Andy Warhol, who discovered so many of the important pop artists at the time, because he just would go downtown and hang around in their studios. And his other life was a curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which was only showing old-fashioned stuff. There was no...
He was only the curator at the Met.
Yeah, but, you know, there were quite a few of them there. But he was the one in charge of contemporary American art, which was a real no-no at the Met. You could find it at MoMA, but not at the Met. The Met is dead art, people who are dead, not living artists. So
the Met struggled to counteract that.
Yeah. So Henry was the one who brought all of this new work to the august, huge galleries at the Met, which was much more prestige for the artist than being at MoMA or the Jewish Museum or one of the museums that already had contemporary art. So I thought to myself, why have them write a book on Henry Geltzahler? It makes a great film. It's so visual with all the artists that he visited and discovered. So I talked them into that. They raised the money from different arts foundations like Dorothy Lichtenstein and Matisse Foundation. And we made this film called Who Gets to Call It Art? The answer to that question is Henry gets to call it art, because he had the rare thing that you don't really find today too often, which was a set of eyes that could tell ahead of time whether a painting was going to be valuable or not. Today, nobody knows that. You know, they take a wild guess, and the market decides it, not the quality of the painting or anything. So Henry, as I said, discovered Andy Warhol and quite a few of the other pop artists. And it turned out to be quite an interesting film. We looked at the downtown art world of the 60s with a kind of sense of humor. It's got some really great, you know, music of the top from the 60s in it. You know, the Rolling Stones and everybody else who was doing work at that point. It got to be quite a well-known film.
Well, and that art lends itself to, it's so cinematic to be able to bring it to the audience.
Yeah, that's why I said don't write a book where you have a few illustrations. This could be a really colorful, fast-paced, funny documentary about pop art and how Henry discovered pop art.
Did you get a chance to meet Henry?
No, I didn't. Oh. He died in... 86, somewhere in 86 or so. I didn't work on this project till 2004.
You were in that downtown art scene.
Oh yeah,
never
no, I never.
Into him.
He was much more of a behind-the-scenes character. He wasn't. he hung out in Warhol's studio a lot in the factory, and I did go there once or twice, but I don't remember ever. I could have, you know, I could have seen him, but not knowing.
A lot of people went in and out of there. Yeah.
I love how in the beginning of the film he meets Ivan Karp, and they ask him, "What's your name?" And he goes, "Henry Galitzer," and they're like, "What? Henry what?" And he goes, "Just call me Henry.
Just call me Henry. That's
call
I know.
Me Henry."
I think that's the poster we made. He's sitting on a big pile of pop art, like garbage, a huge pile of pop art, and you can see all the different, you know, work underneath him. And on the top, it just says Henry, you know, because he was on the top of the art world. And the important thing about that film was, which is very, very unusual for a documentary, in 2006, it was one of the top 10 films on Time magazine's cover. And that was the year of Star Wars, Little Miss, what was that other, some other pop film at the time. And number four was Who Gets to Call It Art? Nobody could believe that a documentary was in the top 10.
I think that should be the number one art film in the art world, because I've been telling every single person to watch this film, and they are just so obsessed and intrigued, especially the art dealers.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is when people make their top 10 lists of art films, it's usually on those lists. There are quite a few other really good films about the art world. The ones that are bad... are the ones about artists, and they try to show the process of art. Like there's some films on Richter, for example, and all you see is now Richter is taking the color and putting it on his spatula. Now you can see him stretch it over the canvas, and now he's blending orange, and nobody cares about that. It's not a story.
No, I love the part.
You need to see the context, really. Yeah. The other people, that was...
You don't want to know how painters paint. You want to know
how
the story.
Live. What they were doing, and
and how it arrives. Really, that's what Warhol's genius is.
I love how John Chamberlain. It's John Chamberlain who talks about artists and being on television and how awkward they are. And Andy Warhol's answer was always a yes or a no. And I never knew that until I watched this film.
Yeah, well, all artists in general are not articulate. You know, when they go on talk shows. It's funny how they don't hardly ever talk about anything. Salvador Dali was like that. And a friend of mine, who actually a very close friend who was a high school classmate who just died, Edward R. Pressman, the producer who made Wall Street and all the Arnold Schwarzenegger films, he just has a new film coming out next month, coming out in September on Dali, called Daliland, which should be really interesting. You know, those are the kind of films that are really... tell you about art and the art world and artists, not the process kind of documentaries that are out there now.
And you are currently about to premiere a film, but we'll get back to that towards the end of this interview. Let's talk about your architecture films and what inspired you to make the Eero Saarinen film.
Well, you know, it's interesting because your questions always still bring me back to the government, to working for the U.S. government back in the 70s and 80s. The group of producers who did Reflections, for which we did the Bernstein film in 1977, when that series ended, after they had done all these famous Americans, the two producers of that retired from USIA and formed their own company to make another series called First Person Singular. And since I had done work for them when they were at USIA, they hired me to do one of their films in that series, which was on I.M. Pei, the Chinese architect. And that was a great project for me because it had been many years since I left architecture school. Always loved architecture, but never had anything to do with it, you know, after leaving school in the first few, just a couple of years of working in architecture in these big offices. But the chance to work on a project with I.M. Pei, to meet him, to see all of his work. And the idea of this series was similar to Reflections. It was letting the subject tell you his or her own story, first person singular. So we went with Pei to almost all of his buildings. The pyramid in the Louvre, the Bank of China in Hong Kong, many, many other projects of his throughout America and Europe and Asia. And so I got to know Pei pretty well. This was done when he was 80 years old for his 80th anniversary. And that opened the door to a whole new field of not just music and art, but architecture as well. And those are the projects that really all kind of sprung from that same source of government-financed filmmaking.
Which again probably promoted architecture as something to be interested in, which is a fantastic cultural.
Yeah.
I mean, architecture is essentially, it's a sculpture, but it's a giant sculpture and it's a monument. Yeah.
Well, especially in the case of a story like I Am Pei, most architects have a signature and everything looks the same. Mm-hmm. You know, Frank Gehry, every building is the same. You know, it's a Frank Gehry building. So why keep doing them if it's always the same idea? Hadid, the woman who died, every Hadid building looks exactly the same. So, there's really no artistic advancement, and these people get onto a certain style. That's what they're commissioned for, and that's what they're expected to do. Same thing happens in the art world. You know, Pollock was expected to do drip paintings. Lichtenstein was expected to do comic books. Warhol was expected to do his style.
Well, again, you're lucky if you find a niche, in a sense. Yeah. Like,
It's human nature. If you find a niche and you're getting famous and you're making money, why change anything? I Am Pei was and Saarinen, who we also made a film on later, they're the two. You okay?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. She's fiddling with a microphone, so I thought maybe the recording stopped, but we're still going here.
The battery just kind of went off in one of my recorders.
So I think that the idea that an architect doing something new each time was really fascinating, and I Am Pei is a perfect example of that. The art museum in Washington, D.C., which is this huge white monolithic building that comes to almost a razor edge point at one corner, is completely different than the all glass and metal pyramid in the Louvre. And that's all different than his Bank of China, which is a huge, 60-story high sculptural piece of structure. So working with architects like I Am Pei and Saarinen, about Saarinen later, was fascinating because these are the real artists. You know, if every project creates a different form because the program is different in that way, then you know that there's some real art behind it, some real innovation, some real imagination.
And with the Eero film, can you describe and talk about the equipment? And because this is when you started moving into or transitioning into the digital electronics.
Yeah, the film on Eero Saarinen.
Yes.
Yeah, that was called The Architect Who Saw the Future, which is relatively recent. We did that a few years ago. It's kind of important for three reasons, that film, in my career, because number one, as you just said, there's certain technical innovations that we could take advantage of at that time. The film was shot in 6K, which is right now we're at kind of finally have gotten to 4K, but the cameraman on that, which I'm going to, who I will talk about in a minute, wanted everything to be a lasting archive of Saarinen's work way into the future, like 50 years from now. 4K is going to be an antiquated system. So he was thinking ahead. There were actually 6K cameras. Today we have 8K cameras in Japan. So this thing is getting to be highly, highly technical. But because the cameras were large 6K cameras on Saarinen shoot, we were the first ones to really do that kind of photography using drones. Up until the time we did the Saarinen film, drones could shoot, but they were small cameras, and they put cameras like GoPros onto a consumer drone, and you could fly around a building, big deal. But when you're shooting 6K or even 4K, the cameras are big, they're heavy, you need an octocopter drone. You need something that almost looks like a small helicopter. And that is a real technology that had not been used in movies before we did it on the Saarinen film. Today, Hollywood is used, I can see in a lot of feature films, you look at Batman and you look at Superman movies, there are drone shots, but we were doing that before those films.
And then there's also a lighting effect that's very unique when you're using this equipment?
Well, it's not so much lighting as a choice of lenses.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, the cameraman was Eric Saarinen, who was the son of Eero Saarinen. And he felt that in order to shoot his father's work, and I totally agreed with him, that architecture can't be looked at as an abstract wide-angle thing like you might do in a painting. You have to show architecture the way you experience it with your eyes. So that you have to match a cinema shot with the way your eyes perceive the same proportions, which means you have to choose the right lens to match what your eyeball sees, not a distortion of that, like the long end of the flat end of a long lens, or the wide, very, you know, you see architecture shot with these super wide fishbowl lenses. One thing that set back architecture photography for years was this fancy still photography that companies like Ezra Stoller did. They would go out, use red filters to make the sky black and the clouds white and wide angle, and it was not, you saw these beautiful buildings, but it was nothing to do with what the building really looked like. So if you ever visited
those
buildings,
because you couldn't move through it, really,
yeah,
is the
right
point.
It's exactly. If you actually go to visit the actual building, you would say that doesn't look like what I saw in pictures at all. This has a completely different feeling to it because the Ezra Stoller pictures distorted architecture. So Eric Saarinen wanted to show architecture the way we see it. And therefore, when we were traveling, we would always travel with his box. He had a box of 10 prime lenses in it. And he would match that lens to each shot so that the actual photograph that we were taking in cinema was the way you would experience going through it. So moving through the building with drones or just walking through the building would give the viewer of the film on Eero Saarinen the same feeling in each one of his buildings as if you were actually there. And that was very rare. You didn't find that in architectural photography at all. And the last thing I want to point out about the Saarinen film is all these documentaries have to have a story. You can't just do a film about an architect and say, here's building one, here's building two, here's building three, here's building four. It would be boring. You can't do that about an artist. You just can't show the artist's paintings and talk about each painting because the audience doesn't know where they are. You can't do that in like a linear way because there's some really stupid film called Joe Papp in Nine Acts. Who's going to want to watch Nine Acts if you know you're working one? Oh my God, I got to wait for number four. Now I got to wait for number five. It makes the thing incredibly boring and unending.
And the thing I love about your films is each one is shot in a different style and manner, especially in the way that you document the subject. So with the Eero film, you know, his son is actually in the film,
yeah,
and there's this emotional connection to work and the architect and this entire backstory that's very sad.
Well, I think that's, Reena, I think you're touching on the key thing when you say story. Now, these films have to have like a story, and they can't be a survey or a linear depiction of what the subject matter is. So the Saarinen film, as you said, is a really good example of that because I knew that Eero Saarinen had a son who was a cinematographer. He had done a lot of Hollywood movies, okay? And so I thought, wouldn't it be a great idea if we were going to shoot all this architecture if we could hire the son to shoot his father's work? So for about a year, I tried to contact Eric Saarinen, who was a very busy cameraman in director of photography in Los Angeles, in Hollywood. And he finally wrote back and saying, Peter, I don't want to have anything to do with your film about my father because I hate my father, hated my father when I was growing up. And I have ignored the name. I'm embarrassed to have the name Saarinen, and I don't want to have anything to do with this. So I said, oh my God, there's a story here, right? We've got to find out why he's talking like that. And it turns out, you know, when Eero Saarinen left his first wife and his son Eric and daughter Susie and just disappeared, just left the family and ran off with a beautiful reporter, Aline Saarinen, Eric was bitter about that from the time he was a 7-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. His whole life. So here am I now calling up saying, we're making a film about your father, who is one of the world's great architects. Do you want to come and shoot it? So of course he said, no, I have nothing to do with this. I finally, after a lot of long emails And he wrote me back in a very moving way. I still have some of his emails, long emails about the problems he had with his father growing up. And I finally convinced him that that's the story. That's the film we want to make. So not only I finally convinced him to shoot the film, he became the subject of the film because I was filming him while he was filming his father, and we traveled all over the country to all the Saarinen buildings. And as he did that, he sort of came to terms and understood who his father really was as an architect and began to admire who his father was. And in a way, it's a redemption, you know, of all of his thoughts. At the end of the film, he says, you know, I really forgive him now for what he did because I realized he was such a great artist. So that's the story of the Saarinen film. But in every film, you do have to find the story like that. You know, we talked about the Clyburn competition. It's the same.
Louis Constant made a great film,
yeah,
by architects.
You know, it's similar. And actually, when I started the Saarinen film, I knew we would be compared to
My Architect.
And they're both very, very good films for that reason. They're more about the personal story and the relationship, family relationships, than the buildings. People don't want to know about architecture. They don't care what is that steel or is that wood, is that glass, you know, is it marble? People don't care about that stuff. They care about the human story in each project. So whether it's about a musician, if you're doing a film about a musician, people don't care about the notes and the score and how come the music is on this particular beat, or, you know.
And the artist can't really explain that anyway, which is, I think, to your point earlier, it's foolish to try to go down that.
And even if you did go down that path, people don't care.
And the artist would probably just tell you he was lucky, kind of fortuitous to find a way to be doing this.
Right, it's like me watching Who Gets to Call It Art, and my favorite clip is Andy Warhol saying yes, no, yes. No, and that I tell everybody this, and they all want to see the film, and they've actually gone and watched the film.
Oh, that's good. So that's why I'm seeing a spike in our Vimeo On Demand page.
Oh, it must be me. I've been sending the link to everyone.
I probably owe you some money, because we made money from that.
Did you?
Yeah, you probably get 50% of that, right?
Or, you know, something else.
But, you know, you mentioned, Rena, the key word. You said everything has a backstory. That's what documentaries are all about. If there's no story, there's no audience interest. So you can't do a documentary that's like a historical, like all this stuff that's on History Channel, you know, it's just sort of geography and background and science. No,
it's boring.
No, it's very boring because there's no story. Now, when a filmmaker locks on to some sort of real human interest story, then it's a good documentary. It doesn't matter whether the subject matter is architecture or art or music or AIDS, or poverty, or civil rights, or racism, whatever it might be. As long as there's a human story behind the documentary, it'll work. And that's the same as what happens in Hollywood. People are making stories. So I don't even like to use the word documentary anymore, because it sets these films apart when they're really all the same in terms of how do you tell a story. It's better to say like nonfiction.
Work.
Say nonfiction.
Right.
Nonfiction cinema.
Speak of you to other people, and they're mainly in the art world, I just tell everyone you make art films, because that's essentially what they are.
Yeah, that's one way to put it.
Films
yeah,
about
sure.
art. Speaking of art films and subjects and personalities and humans, let's talk about Larry Rivers.
Okay,
Bad Boy of the Art World
is another one of these projects that I had my eye on for many years before actually making it. As a matter of fact, the Larry Rivers project goes back to where we started this whole talk about me at Yale. It's part of that Joe Levine filmmaking grant. There was a course that was set up called Writing for the Camera. It was taught by a brilliant filmmaker, Michael Romer, who's now in his 90s. But he made Nothing But a Man, which was the first movie where two black actors, Abby Lincoln and Ivan Dixon, actually kissed on camera. It was the first time in Hollywood that two black people ever kissed, which was groundbreaking.
What year is this?
1962 or something like that.
That's a really...
Michael Romer. And then Michael Romer made a very good comedy called... The Plot Against Harry or something like that. At any rate, Michael was teaching this course at Yale called Writing for the Camera, and it was a fellowship that Joe Levine paid everybody a stipend of $3,000 to take this course in that year after graduation. And one of my classmates was Arnold Weinstein, who was a playwright. Arnold wrote Dynamite Tonight, which was a famous early 60s off-Broadway musical, and plus other things. So Arnold Weinstein got to be a friend, and then this was like mid-1970s. Then I didn't hear from him again for 20 years, and I get a call, and he goes, "Peter, this is your friend from Yale, Arnold Weinstein. I'm sitting in a room with the painter, Larry Rivers, and I'm helping him write his autobiography. And the more we get into it, the more I realize this is a crazy documentary to make, because Larry was a crazy person, broke all the boundaries of how we normally live our lives. All the taboos were broken by him. And you should come out here and meet him and see what this book is all about." I didn't pay too much attention to that until the book came out that Arnold and Larry wrote, called What Did I Do, which is one of the great art books of all time. You should read that, What Did I Do, which is the autobiography of Larry Rivers. So finally when I read the book, I thought, well, he was right. That makes a really great documentary. Now, this is mid-90s. Again, nothing really happened on this. I did meet Larry Rivers a few times in galleries or whatever.
What was he like? I hardly remember
him in person because I only met him once or twice.
Okay.
He's a tall, good-looking guy, big pointed nose.
He was very good-looking, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some women would think he was good-looking and some women wouldn't because he was very different-looking.
Well, when he was younger and when he wore those suits and was very clean-looking, good-looking.
Good figure, tall, thin.
Right. As he became more and more perverse.
He was a major druggie, and drugs seem to do that to people's personal features. Their faces sort of droop down, and they start to look ugly if they're really addicts. But aside from all that, about all these years went by, and then I had met Larry a few times, and then I guess when this goes back to Who Gets to Call It Art, we premiered Who Gets to Call It Art in the Hamptons Film Festival, which was ideal for that film because Henry Geltzahler lived in the Hamptons. In Southampton, there's a bench with a plaque on it saying Henry Geltzahler sat in this bench, and he's
really
a famous character out there.
You're going to have to show me where that bench is.
So
I have to sit on that bench.
So we, you'll have to take a picture of you and the plaque.
Yes.
But so when we premiered the Henry Geltzahler film at the Hamptons Film Festival, which got great press, there are all these Hollywood films there, and we got more press than any other film in the Hamptons Film Festival because he was a local guy and Henry Geltzahler was well known there. I remember that Stallone, the actor, the guy from Rocky,
had a new film at the
same festival. And I was at some reception or some party, and we're drinking, and Sylvester Stallone comes up. He says, "Peter Rosen, how come your documentary is getting more press than my new film?" He's all pissed off at that.
Because it's good.
Yeah.
Because it's good.
But at any rate,
well, just goes to show Stallone takes his art seriously, which he does, actually.
But so at that festival, a guy came up to me and said, "Peter, I like that film you made on Henry Geltzahler. I'm the president of the Larry Rivers Foundation out here in Bridgehampton, and we should talk about making a film about Larry." So this is now about 2000, somewhere in there, 2005, 2003. So this project, which we're now just finishing, if you think about it, started at Yale when I first met Arnold Weinstein in 1973. So what are we talking about now? That's 50 years ago. The idea for a film on Larry Rivers sort of was born, followed through at the Hamptons Film Festival when the president of the foundation, a very brilliant painter in his own right, David Joel is his name, came up to me and said, "Let's make a film." So I began to work with the foundation on this film about 10 or 12 years ago. And then as it developed, a lot of things happened along the way. Number one, one morning we open up the New York Times and Vanity Fair magazine and see these huge articles about Larry Rivers accused of molesting his two daughters. So all of a sudden, this project changed. And I went out to the offices where David Joel was, and that next morning he was really upset that he felt that by the daughters making this claim that they were molested by him, that they had basically ruined the legacy of Larry Rivers. You don't do that. No matter how much you push boundaries as an artist, as a writer, whatever, you don't molest your daughters. It turns out he never really molested them sexually or had any physical contact with them. But when they were young, he painted them in very suggestive poses, naked. He filmed them naked. And they are being asked to talk about their breasts growing, their bodies developing, their first sexual feelings. And it's sort of an invasion of privacy of your daughters. You have daughters.
I have daughters.
I have a daughter. I would never think of talking to my daughter on that subject. You know, if I never even talked to my daughter about anything to do with sex, it would be embarrassing, you know. Let the teachers do that or something. But Larry Rivers was so outrageous and so out there, he felt there were no boundaries about this kind of thing. So the project, we were about halfway doing this film when this happened. It was a cover story on Vanity Fair. And the New York Times, 2 days in a row, wrote a front page piece about Larry Rivers and the daughters. And I said to myself, that turns the corner on this project a little bit. It's not just about an artist who was doing new things and doing outrageous things and pushing those boundaries. Now it becomes a real family human story. So we interviewed one of the daughters, we interviewed Larry's wife when all this was happening. And we interviewed a lot of people in the art world about this whole theme of, are artists people who have the right to transcend the normal behavior that the rest of us have to live within these boundaries? Or are artists people who are put on this earth for a special reason to express whatever they want, and we can't tell them what to do and what not to do and what's off limits and what not is off limits? And that's sort of what this film is all about. And it's just about finished now. And it's coming out, I think, at a very interesting time. As a matter of fact, Lena and I are going to have a meeting coming up next week with a PR firm that's interested in trying to present this idea to the public.
I think they will present it in the right manner to the right people.
Yeah. Well, it's very sensitive because we're in the middle of this cancel culture world.
That's right.
Well,
and Larry Rivers would have been
anymore. So
I know,
well,
but
really
still,
he
would have been the first one to be canceled.
Or the daughter. I guess it depends on if the daughters have seen. If the project has a way of seeing through or making your point.
And the other thing is, we were talking about story earlier. This project with Larry has this same redemptive story, that there's a controversy about what happened, but we found out at the end of this film, as I was talking to one of the daughters, that when he was dying on his deathbed, the whole family came together and they all sort of forgave him because they realized how much family meant to him. His last painting, which is featured in this documentary, is of the whole family together sitting on a porch, and it's a beautiful portrait. And the daughter looks at it and says, you know, I realized that was really the most important thing in his life was family, and I forgive him for what he did. So there's again that story of redemption is the same as in the film, you know, on Saarinen's son. It's on the same as the film that, you know, we made about the blind pianist, Nobuyuki Tsuji.
Which is one of my favorite films. You've made several films.
Winning the Clyburn after being born blind and being able to achieve that kind of limit.
And which says something about pushing boundaries really in itself.
Yeah.
Blind I think that's prodigy.
A fascinating
and this is what makes great documentaries when at the end there is that final act of redemption. So with Larry Rivers, I think it's going to be an important film. Rena has seen it, only a few other people, because it is very sensitive. When I was making it, I was getting calls from like feminist groups who heard about this film. I got a call from a lawyer one day saying, I represent an important feminist. What can we do to have you not make this film?
Really?
Yeah.
I get different feedback than what you just said. A lot of the women and feminists and lesbians can't wait to see the film. They actually want to see, you know, how bad it used to be, you know, because they remember.
Well, that's really important, because that might be why the film could be successful in today. Now, we could have finished this film 5 years ago, or 3 years ago. Then we didn't do anything during the pandemic. people weren't available for interviews and things like that, so we lost 2 years there. But I'm really glad that it's coming out now as opposed to when we could have finished it 4 or 5 years ago, because now we're kind of turned a corner on all of this. I think people are a little more understanding and see a bigger picture about relationships between men and women, and how the feminist movement may have been a little too fast, too soon for some people. I think the film will really make an important
statement. But I also want to point out that a lot of feminists that I personally know, I think, want to support the film because it supports their cause. It's sort of like it juxtaposes what they have been fighting for, and they are eager to see it. And you know, I tell them I've watched it.
Well, we interviewed a
well, at least the conversation should be out there. It's like you said, if you cancel the conversation, then there's no chance to.
Well, this is definitely about the conversation, through the work of an artist who always put women on pedestals, sort of like pinup pictures.
Right. But he was a great artist, which is
that's the underlying importance of it is Larry Rivers, Rauschenberg, and Jasper Johns were probably the three most important American artists because they broke away from the abstract expression. Mm-hmm. American art was all European based. It was all de Kooning and Pollock and European based artists.
I mean, Larry was just a very open and loud Picasso. That's the way I kind of look at him.
Yeah. And have an artist been painting nude children since the beginning of time, really?
Sure.
Right. If you try to cancel that,
well, let's just cancel all the nude models everywhere.
Get rid of every fragonard in the net.
Or you know, some great photographers like Mapplethorpe.
Right. Let's just whitewash all the paintings at the Met.
What about Mapplethorpe? Yeah. You know, they're outrageous pictures of the penises, erect penises, and. Who else? There are many artists who have done much more outrageous work than Larry Rivers.
All the ceilings at the Vatican. All the babies.
Show a lot of that in the film.
Okay.
There's the Courbet's Origins of the World, which is just a big
oil painting. It doesn't invalidate the daughters either. It's like you said, there's a story there.
Yeah.
And that's
But I think what I was going to open the film, we had a different opening at one point. It was going to be what I told you about this phone call. It was going to be me sitting at a desk in my office. The phone rings. I pick it up and you hear this voice saying, "I represent Gloria Steinem. What can you do to not make this film, Peter Rosen?"
It's Gloria Steinem.
How we would do the opening of the film. But then I figured that was sort of fake, so we didn't want to.
I have sent the link and told a lot of people in the art world about who gets to call it art, and I've mentioned Larry Rivers, and they're all waiting for the premiere, just to let you know.
Well, you know what we should do? You could really help me with this. We have to figure out, I've been trying to premiere it in the Hamptons, because Larry lived out there. He was, like Henry Geltzahler, one of the real art luminaries in the Hamptons. But I was saying before about being an important artist, there are only three people who broke away from abstract expressionism, which was the only American art. Color field painting, abstract expressionism, Pollock. And they began to put actual literal real images on canvas. That was a huge turning point in American art. And only
you're saying Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns,
and Rivers. They were the only three artists during this time of abstract expression. It was real heresy to do what they were doing. To do something that wasn't abstract was really heretic. I mean, you were looked at like an amateur or an American Indian or something like that if you did a realistic kind of painting.
Well, so, I can't wait to get people's, because I've luckily been able to get a director's cut, preview of the Larry.
Sounds fascinating. I want to see it too.
Yeah.
No, we could send him the link.
Sure. You're special. Yeah. You're part of this podcast.
Yeah, we don't want to kind of haphazardly get this out there. Now, the problem in the Hamptons is we know some key people who run Guildhall, who run the Parish Art Museum, and we have inquired about whether they want to show it, and they're all kind of getting cold feet. They say, "Oh my God, we love this film, but can we really show it to our highbrow audience out here in the Hamptons?"
Yeah, I think so. I think they need to see. They want to see it, especially if it's made by you.
They're hesitant to do it.
I mean, you made the number 4 Time magazine film that Sylvester Stallone came up to you, right, and said, "Why is your film more important than mine?" Why not? Who would not want to see another art film that was made by you? And this movie in particular, all these women, I'm telling you, there's a gang of women that I know that are artists, that are female, that are feminists, who really want to see it.
We interviewed some feminist artists for the film who were very tough on Larry Rivers in the film. So we do have a cross-section of opinions about him. You know, I had a rough cut screening without that, and some women who saw it said, we think you need to add a feminist perspective on who he was. So I went to some artists who...
I think we should do a screening and just only invite women and see their reaction.
Well, just to show them.
You know, you do that.
Okay, I'll do it.
You know, it really is the film community.
You do that. I'm going to sit incognito in the back row with my sunglasses on.
The film community really is probably the most terrified people, because they're the ones who really get subjected to the canceling and this and that.
I can't wait to get the reaction. And thank you so much for letting me interview you. It was really a privilege.
Well, it was fun. I'm glad we talked.
Yeah. And thank you for letting us
have this conversation.
Great host. So we're going to wrap this up, and I will see you very soon.